This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a butter egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/hrn.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking about the United States' biggest crop. It's corn.
They will always tell you that corn is like their family. Corn is their family. You treat corn like you would treat your family.
These subsidy programs are supposed to be for really dealing with unexpected things that happen to farmers. Although in practice, a lot of times, farmers are actually paid farm subsidies for things that we can control and do expect.
There's this constant warfare going on between the oil industry and the grain industry.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Why Food, a podcast about entrepreneurs, innovators, and career changers. I'm your lone co-host, Ethan Frisch. Valerie is back next week, but I'm really excited to introduce you to our guest this week. Sue Betty is the founder and head coach of Bluebird Hospitality in Burlington, Vermont. Sue, thanks for joining me.
Hi, Ethan. Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Likewise. Despite being virtual for at least a year at this point, it's still pretty rare that we talk to people outside of New York. And I'm really interested in hearing your perspective, especially around your work with the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which we'll get to a little later. But why don't we start with a little background? How did you get into food?
I first started working in restaurants, I think in high school, in the Adirondacks at kind of like a resort town. And I was at a marina restaurant nightclub operation for about 5 years. And I did a little bit of everything over that time. And then I continued working in restaurants pretty much throughout my career, on and off.
And you also have an education background, right? Some training and education?
Yeah, after I graduated St. Michael's College in Vermont, my first official career job was as the head coach at Siena College's women's lacrosse. And from there, I spent about 5 years in higher education and finished up a master's degree in higher education at the University of Vermont.
And how did you decide to come back to food? Was that something that you had always wanted to do, or did that kind of occur to you later?
Does destiny count?
Yeah, sure.
I never seemed to be able to kind of get away. I really learned a lot and grew a lot during my time in higher ed. At the same time, I really felt like kind of a draw to maybe more of an entrepreneurial life versus like a higher ed kind of leans a little bit more bureaucratic. And I kind of realized that as I was going to progress in college athletics, that I'd be moving a lot from college to college to progress my career. And I really felt like I wanted to set roots somewhere and build something.
That entrepreneurial start is so hard for so many people, especially people who have come from sort of like you did, a world or an industry where things are bureaucratic and tend to be very process driven. What was that like, starting your own restaurant, your own company for the first time? What were some of those initial challenges and successes?
That's a really good question. Cause in moments it was exciting and, you know, opportunity was there and there was a thrill and I think I just entered in with this like earnestness, maybe a little bit of naivete. And then there was moments of, like, wow, this is stressful and wow, this is complicated. And, you know, it was in 2009 and social media was just kind of coming online and social reviews were just coming online. And I was 29 years old and I just found myself kind of in this very public business with a public presence. And as someone that kind of leans introverted, it was a roller coaster.
Yeah, I can imagine. What was the first? You've opened a series of restaurants, and maybe it's worth talking a little bit about your current, or I should say, primary restaurant at the moment. But the first restaurant you opened was a very different concept. Would you tell us a little bit about it and how you've kind of expanded the type of food that you make and the concept of the restaurants that you run?
Yeah, so I guess backing up right after I finished up my higher ed degree and I decided to transition back into the food world full time, I went out to Berkeley, California for about 3 years. And I studied natural foods cooking and ancestral diets and worked in some really cool places and just immersed myself in the Berkeley food scene, which was just an amazing education. And, you know, working with natural foods and kind of holistic healing cooking was very interesting to me. But I also, in my classwork, I looked around and I just found, like, a lot of my classmates were there because they were healing from some significant health problem that was holding them back. And I found that, like, the hyper focus on, like, what you ate and, like, the vigilance and some of, like, the energy behind that, I was like, I don't really know if anyone's feeling any better. So I started to kind of visualize the first restaurant that we opened, Bluebird Tavern, as being, like, just whole foods focused, from scratch focused, but not necessarily like a love your liver burger type of restaurant. And there's nothing wrong with that. I wanted to kind of get back to food roots and investigate that and create a restaurant that would kind of celebrate the food roots of New England and whole foods cooking and just kind of real food. And that was the start of Bluebird Tavern.
It seems like Vermont and maybe Burlington in particular has such a strong tradition of local food and puts so much value on traceability and sourcing, way more, I think, than other food scenes I've seen elsewhere in the country. Why do you think that is, and how has that kind of affected the growth of your businesses and the way that you've positioned them?
Sometimes I feel like I should be like a commercial for Vermont because I'm such a fan. But it's an incredible place to live, and it's an incredible place to live and work in food. Our population is 600,000 total for the state. You know, it kind of boggles my mind the innovation and the talent that we have in our food world, you know, from restaurants to farmers to brewers to producers. It just seems to be this place where there's been some sort of magnet where everyone's congregated to create like a really innovative and forward-thinking food scene that I think really leads the way in the U.S. for sure in a lot of ways.
Where do you think that comes from? Why is it so strong there?
I've thought about that a lot. I grew up in upstate New York, which is like across the lake in Lake Champlain. And, you know, that area is beautiful in its own way. And I've just been like, is there something in like the rock foundation of Vermont that kind of creates this energy? I don't know. I think there's something that we're able to do in Vermont, which is still be able to be very focused on community. We're still very tied to the land in many ways. And I think that a lot of people who've grown up here or who choose to relocate here really are kind of seeking like a really cool way of life.
Yeah, I haven't spent a ton of time there, but my brother went to UVM, and so I got to visit Burlington several times, and just my trips through the state, the food options available, even in kind of unremarkable supermarkets, are really incredible. The local sourcing programs that they have in place. Do you think it was easier to do for your restaurants because that infrastructure existed? Did you have to kind of track down new suppliers or set up new systems, or were you able to just sort of plug into what was already there?
We were able to plug in. Vermont had and still does have a great organization called the Vermont Fresh Network, which sole focus originally was to link farmers with outlets and restaurants and grocery. And I think they set up the infrastructure that was, I believe, in the late 90s. So we were able to latch on to that.
And let's talk a little bit about Bluebird Barbecue, which is your current restaurant and kind of an iconic place. You've been featured on Guy Fieri's Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, and you've gotten a lot of national press. How do you explain the popularity, or what are you doing there that's so special?
I think barbecue is special. I'm like honestly not like a hardcore carnivore. I'm like an appreciator of food in like a lot of different ways. But what I appreciate most about barbecue is like it is able to reach this sense of nostalgia in so many people. And it is this like comfort food, but at the same time, there's an art to it. And I just find that so compelling as a concept. And it's a food to share and a food to be together. And I just, you know, at Bluebird Barbecue, we have, you know, prior to COVID, when we were in full operation, it would be like sauces were on the table and people were passing sauces and people were getting seated and seeing their neighbors. And it just had a really great feel. And we've just been really blessed to have an incredible team there that's really kind of created this, I think, brand that's like lighthearted and fun and friendly and makes people feel good. And that's like, for me, just feels right. And, you know, it's like kind of magical.
What makes the food distinctive? What do people come back for in terms of the barbecue itself?
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of times like restaurants are about curiosity and, you know, you step in and then you look at the menu and you kind of wonder what you're going to get and like barbecue is, at least in our experience, has like kind of the opposite. Like I'm having, you know, this type of day and I need to go treat myself and I want the brisket at Bluebird. Like before folks walk in the door, if they're returning guests, they usually know what they want. So there's something about like the comfort of consistency and that really, I think, connects with people, you know. And then for us, like the challenge is creating that consistency day in and day out.
And how do you do that? I guess what I'm looking for is a little more detail on how you're doing the barbecue. What style is it? How is it being? Is it being smoked? Is it being grilled? Talk to me about the food a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So when, you know, we're in Vermont, you know, and I do think that every culture, every region does have, you know, cooking over fire, smoking in their traditions. But for sure in the U.S., the South is, you know, owned barbecue and a lot, and it's like a way of life down there. For us, it was not so getting detail oriented into like regional barbecue cooking, but really looking at each ingredient and celebrating those ingredients and like creating recipes and smoke schedules that brought the best out in those ingredients. So we have a smokehouse outside the restaurant with a giant smoker that's wooden gas fired that's running pretty much 24/7.
Are you the one turning the spits or you know doing that 18-hour cooking process? Who supervises the smoking?
We have an amazing chef Dan Miele and awesome culinary team, and they've really been running the show for years now. You know, I've spent some time around barbecue and particularly when we have our food truck out and at the festivals, but I'm not hands-on in the kitchen day in and day out. I'm definitely more focused on the company and Bluebird and the team and those parts of the work.
Yeah, and I did want to ask about that too, because you do have such a depth of experience and have owned several restaurants and I think have a unique approach to running a restaurant and managing the team. Could you talk us through that philosophy or your value system in running the business?
You know, what I've learned, I'm 10 years in to running the business, and what I've learned, what's most important is like, I have to keep growing and I have to keep learning and I have to keep reflecting and, you know, improve myself as a person. And as I've gained experience and more learning and learned how to work with folks and, you know, learned how to guide the business and learn how to be like a, you know, a leader, which is, I think, a lifelong learning lesson. That's my first look is I've got to set those standards for myself and try to keep working it. And, you know, looking back to my early part of my career, I can definitely see moments and many, you know, where I'm like, oh boy, you know? So that's my first look is really learning for myself and improving myself. And then, you know, my hope, my ongoing hope is to create a work environment at Bluebird where people want to step through the door every day It's a safe space to work. It's a positive place to work. It's a place where people make friends and feel belonging. Like, that is my number one goal. And then mapping that to running a successful business and creating a guest experience that people want to come back for.
And you had also introduced yourself as the head coach, and especially given your sports coaching experience, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the coaching aspects of your job as well.
Yeah. It's so funny. I turning back to 2009 and just coming out of a lot of coaching experience, and coaching is like a really interesting first job, because you're really looking at building teams and then individuals. You're looking to advance and help them improve and shine. And I think my early part of my career at Bluebird, I may have like disconnected from that a little bit, because I felt like I had to be serious and run things like a business. And, you know, I think we all worked in restaurants, and that's the model, you know. So you kind of return to that. And it took me about 5 years to realize that I was like leaving a lot of myself out of that, and that I was leaving a lot of like what I had learned in higher ed out of it. And so I think the second half of the last 10 years, I've been trying to bring more of that forward. And, I did rebrand myself as head coach, because I had a couple of, like, overhearing people call me the boss, and I just kind of cringed. So I was like, I gotta work on this brand, because I don't really feel connected to being a boss. I really feel connected to, you know, being a coaching leader that helps, you know, co-create a vision with the team, and then optimally like helps every team member like find new open doors for themselves.
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge, right? I mean, for my company, which obviously has a much smaller staff than yours does, being a, you know, primarily an e-commerce business, we've hired basically everybody over the last year. And I'm sort of thinking through that process myself. Like, what does it mean to be a boss when I don't really know that much more in many cases than the people I'm supposed to be supervising or are the employees of my company. And in many cases, they know a lot more, which is why we've hired them. I don't know. Do you have any pieces of advice for me or for other fairly early stage entrepreneurs who are trying to navigate that complicated professional and social situation?
I think be really kind to yourself when you make mistakes. You know, I think that's like inevitable. It's always a bummer when you kind of reflect and you're like, I really should have handled that differently. And it impacted someone. I mean, that's kind of like the challenge of like having, you know, power and decisions. So what I've had to learn for myself is to be a little bit more kind to myself when I've made the mistakes, and then try to reroute myself. So like moving forward, there's systems in place to help us have like more guardrails and decisions and more guardrails and how we handle like a team member conflict. So we've really been focusing on getting systems down on paper and kind of growing from like being a restaurant to being like a company.
Yeah. And how does the sort of customer facing aspect of your work and your team's work interact with that aspect of it? Because that's, you know, we've been thinking about that. Also, several of the people who work for us at Burlap and Barrel are primarily customer support people who are responding to customer emails. And, you know, we do what we can to keep people happy, but at some point there's only so much you can do. And I've kind of been thinking about the process of management similar to the way that we handle customer issues or complaints or requests in general. We want to keep people happy. We want to make things run as smoothly as possible. But at some point there are things that you can and things that you can't do. Do you find that there's overlap between a customer service philosophy and an internal kind of an internal system, or do they exist totally separately? Maybe I'm going in the wrong direction with this.
No, you know, I think like they're completely connected, because it's really important that, you know, from like the leadership lens, that there's a lot of listening that happens. And I think if we generate the space for our team members to bring issues up to us and listen and give space to that, we model it there, when it happens on the floor with a guest, it's kind of drawn out of that initial like support system.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based customers into your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can get started with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat. And it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen, pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andres called Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says, "So good, I feel guilty eating it." Put the fastest-growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
And we're back. My guest this week is Sue Betty, head coach and founder of Bluebird Hospitality in Vermont. Sue, I also wanted to talk a little bit about your work with the Independent Restaurant Coalition, which has gotten quite a bit of press over the last year and has presented some solutions, potentially controversial in some cases, to the crisis in the restaurant industry. Could you give us a little background on the work that needs to be done and how the Independent Restaurant Coalition is responding?
Sure. Yeah, I was connected. As soon as the pandemic became kind of like the reality, the pandemic for our industry kind of came to everyone's awareness, which is late March last year. It was, almost this existential crisis for independent restaurants. And I became involved with the Independent Restaurant Coalition through like a network of friends, and they had already gained some momentum with the initial founding group. And over time, it's grown to about, 80 to 100 folks on our leadership circle from across the United States. With the one single purpose was to, preserve our restaurant industry through the crisis. And it's been an incredible journey and an amazing group of restaurateurs that have come together in this really collaborative and supportive and powerful way. And there was a real focus on telling our story. So folks in the government and policy really changed to support independent restaurants specifically. And that work, like for me, was incredibly interesting and incredibly inspiring. And I think like there was a lot of calls and a lot of outreach and a lot of advocacy, lobbying, like all of that. It was really intense for a period, but at the same time, I just feel so blessed to be part of a group during that period that we could actually like do something and take action and tell our story. So it was like personally powerful for me in a way that like, I don't even know if I'll understand, until for a couple more years.
What did you see in terms of impact or movement, some of the effects of that advocacy that you were involved in?
This was like an unprecedented situation for everyone. the intricacies of the pandemic and how it was impacting certain sectors and where the government was at last year was a little bit, I think we all know, just is a strange combination of energies. So for me, I think that what was really important was getting small independent restaurants the chance to tell their story and how their businesses are really disrupted. And there's no, like, you have no cards to play at the table. And, you know, meanwhile, fixed costs, rent, all of those things were kind of adding up. And it was paralyzing for a period. And early relief that came out of with the PPP program really wasn't exactly what the industry needed, and because of like the status of our industry. So we did a lot of work to try to make changes to that and to continually promote like this sector of the economy is so critical and we need to keep the sector intact. So we need a specific program designed to save restaurants, which we you know, after a year, we just recently saw pass with the Restaurant Revitalization Fund.
It does seem to me like the needs of restaurants would be very different based on context, based on where they are and how big, you know, a three Michelin starred restaurant in, I don't know, Las Vegas or something might have a different set of priorities than you would. Was that an issue? How did you and the other restaurateurs involved navigate that?
The focus of the Independent Restaurant Coalition was always on the independence. And I would say we have, actually some of the most celebrated folks in the industry kind of leading the way. And they always were pointing back to, you know, not always about like, this is like what's going to work for my restaurant group. But the thought process was always about like the neighborhood restaurants, the corner delis, like all the folks that are, you know, just kind of living what we think the American dream is and, you know, owner operators working day in and day out and just making sure that they survived. Like, I think that was the driving force and the energy behind the IRC. And it was inspiring. I saw some folks rally behind decisions that would actually cut their restaurant group out of being a beneficiary, but just making those calls because they believe so much in like the small shops of our industry.
Yeah, there were some of those high profile stories early on of chains. I won't name any names, but chains who had gotten PPP loans or relief in one way or another, and then wound up giving them back partially because of public pressure. That at least was my perception looking in from the outside. Was that something that was a priority for you and the IRC, or was that really internal? Were those decisions that were being made by those different restaurant groups?
I can't speak for the IRC on this, but just my perspective was like that initial like close down period where everyone was scrambling. I actually think the chains were scrambling too. And so I don't have a lot of criticism for anyone that could meet the whatever PPP rules were taking it. Like that was what was put in front of folks. So I think that what the challenge was like who was able to access the PPP early. And there was some issues if you didn't have a banking relationship or access to those relationships, you were boxed out, which seemed to be corrected over time as there was revision after revision.
Yeah. It was definitely a moment of crisis and everybody was trying to do whatever they could. But I think one of the concerns across the industry, I mean, even for me personally, living in New York City, which we've seen this shift over the last, you know, many years anyway, the closing of longstanding neighborhood businesses, family owned or independently owned, and this huge growth of chains, old chains, new chains, you know, just sure. Filling in all of those spaces and making it harder for the independents to stand out and compete. Do you think, is there a silver lining through COVID that trend might change directions, that we might make it easier for independent restaurants to open and operate?
You know, what I've learned this past year, just, you know, so this is my experience, like working with, we have just to kind of level set, we have an amazing delegation in Vermont. We have Senator Sanders, Senator Leahy, Congressman Welch, just a really connected, you know, group of folks that really care about Vermont and Vermonters. And so I have like just respect and admiration for their work and the way they reached out to us. I think at the same time, just kind of glimpsing in how the game is played within government and lobbying, and for us to be under government mandate that we couldn't operate the business in a way that, you know, allowed us to be a business, and to have to lobby so hard to let people know that we were in crisis and that, you know, our industry was failing, and to kind of have that not move more quickly forward, to have the fund that was needed to save our industry take a year. It gave me, like, I had to think a lot about, like, what the relationship is between, like, government and particularly, like, small business. And I feel like there's some tensions between business and policy and business. And I'm just, my hope is that where we can get out of the pandemic is, like, becoming, like, more aligned in an alliance, so we can build economies that thrive in the small business world, and we can empower small business owners to be better employers and to support our communities. And I think, you know, there may be an opportunity, like, for sure here in Vermont, we're working for that. But, you know, what I just kind of saw last year was just a lot of, like, pushing against and trying to be louder. And it was just interesting and disappointing and frustrating. And then just kind of realizing, like, oh, this is how this works.
Yeah. And you've also been involved in some advocacy work specifically in Vermont. Would you tell us a little bit about that and how it's going and where it's going?
Yeah, I'll go back to my Vermont commercial. It's definitely, you know, if I had to pick a state, just because being on the, you know, Independent Restaurant Coalition and hearing stories about how each state, since each state was handling things differently, you could really see how each state's policies were impacting different restaurants. You know, for us, we had a small group of restaurateurs and I put together a coalition early, right around March 17th, to help just kind of seeing what was going to happen. We just knew we needed a collective effort to support our industry. And the cool thing about living in Vermont is, like, you can pick up the phone and definitely talk to people that make decisions. It wasn't, you know, very difficult to get to the governor's office and let them know, like, this is what's happening. And there was back and forth the whole time, and it was much more collaborative. And I think we generated a really positive outcome with a robust state grant program that I think kept pretty much our whole Vermont restaurant industry intact. And I really have to credit, like, the work of the coalition and our legislators and the governor's team for really coming together to put together a program that mattered.
Yeah. I mean, it's great, and great to hear that at least somewhere it's being done right. And on that same note, what do you think of the national program, of the bill that was just passed?
Well, that, you know, that was really shaped by the IRC early on, and it's designed to support restaurants. So where early PPP had a lot of restrictions on use of funds and how it was allocated, like, this program should really work to support restaurants. The biggest challenge that we see coming up is that, you know, it's potentially not funded to the level of need. But we've heard word that if there is a funding issue, that there'll be some future monies reallocated. So I'm holding the highest optimism that the federal grant will come in at the right time when operators really need it to keep their businesses intact, and it'll help carry teams forward.
Do you have any advice or resources you might recommend for a restaurant owner or operator who is looking to understand this a little bit better and understand how they might get access to some of that support?
Yeah, it's the IRC's website is saverestaurants.com, and they have a great resource section and a way to connect and get in touch and get on an email newsletter list. So I would start there.
All right. Let's do a little rapid fire before we wrap up. Are you ready for some tricky questions?
Okay.
All right. If you were a vegetable, what vegetable would you be?
What came to mind immediately was a carrot.
Okay.
And I don't know why that is, but, like, orange, bright, nurturing.
Yeah, sounds delicious. And you can eat the leaves too. If I don't know if that makes a carrot. how about your desert island kitchen tool? What do you find yourself reaching for more than anything else when you're cooking?
I was just staring at my microplane, and I was like, we've been together a long time, and we might have to re-up, but you know, we, at the same time, I feel like I've got like a kitchen friend there.
Yeah, that's a good one. It doesn't get, people don't say microplane as often as you might think, but it's come up a few times, and I think it's one of those really, unsung, kitchen workhorses. I think people don't realize how versatile it can be and how many ways you can use it. Is there a wacky thing that you use your microplane for that you think other people might not?
I just think like a little lemon zest on just about everything always is the way to go.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good move. How about your favorite dish on the menu at Bluebird Barbecue?
Oh, that's a good question. We have a barbecue ramen that we're going to be moving to a seasonal option soon, but so we're going to be saying farewell to that in the near future, but it's definitely, I think, this like amazing dish. It's got all the smoky kind of cool elements from our barbecue in this amazing broth. And it's just really like, just feels good the whole way through.
That sounds amazing. Was there a sort of an iconic dish or restaurant experience that you ate when you lived in Berkeley that kind of woke you up to the new direction for food that hadn't spread really to the rest of the country yet, but had built such a home for itself in Berkeley?
I could just go on and on. I think, you know, you have to give a nod to Chez Panisse. Just walking, I lived three blocks up, and just walking by the front of the restaurant and the aesthetic and the vision and all the work they've done over the years, it just like almost like comes off the place. And then I think my time in Berkeley, I was exposed to like Blue Bottle Coffee when it was a farm stand, vendor. And just getting like into the world of coffee and how amazing it was. But really everything in Berkeley, I just remember just being like so focused on these amazing ingredients and these amazing stories. And that's stuck with me through my whole career.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, what a special time to sort of be introduced to the food world or the professional food world, I should say. It's almost legendary at this point, right?
Yeah. I still like think back on like all these little moments and I'm always like, wow. And even then being there, I knew it was cool, you know?
Yeah. Okay. I have to ask, maybe you could tell me that you don't want to answer this, but how often does Bernie Sanders come in for barbecue?
I haven't seen Bernie too much at barbecue. I do see him around town. So maybe when he returns from DC after this, interview airs, we'll be able to do a welcome in. But we're still operating it to go only just because of the COVID impact. So hopefully this summer we'll have everyone that's been involved in saving restaurants stopping by for some barbecue.
Do we know what Bernie likes to eat?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. This is going to give me something to do this summer.
Figure out what he likes and put it on the menu. Sounds like fun. Sue, where can our listeners learn more about you and your work, order at your restaurants if they're local to Burlington or passing through Vermont and follow the Restaurant Coalition?
Yeah, I mean, when it's safe to travel again, everyone please come to Vermont. We're up in Burlington. Website is bluebirdbarbecue.com. And I'm on Instagram at sue.betty. And I take a lot of pictures of sunrises. So if you like sunrises, come follow me there.
Sounds great. As always, you can reach us by email, yfood@heritageradionetwork.org, and on social at yfoodpodcast. You can follow me via my spice company, Burlap and Barrel, at Burlap and Barrel on Instagram. And you can follow Valerie on Instagram at foodie in New York. Thanks to the Red Crickets for our theme song, Blind. And thanks to Armin Spengen, our, as always, amazing sound engineer. And most of all, Sue, thank you for joining me. This was such an interesting conversation and really gave some context for the work that the IRC has been doing and how it's all going.
It was a pleasure. Thank you, Ethan.
Talk to you all next week.
Why Food is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.